this.
Once more under the breach, dear friend.
Else close the wall up with our English dead.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting episode of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure.
And we're getting a little bit of problem with our headsets. Are you getting that? Is it really faint for you as well?
Well, it was until I turned the volume up. But the music was nice and loud.
Okay. So that's all good.
That's good. And this is KTEM, and this is the Personal Wealth Coach, and I wish I could tell you that we had a telephone number for you to call into, or into which you could call, if I were to use proper English, but we don't, so you're just going to have to listen to us.
Yes? I'll have you know that the proper English has been changed within the last 2 years. Dangling participles are now appropriate. It's a big deal.
In public?
Yeah, participles can dangle anywhere you want now.
Is this part of the Trump initiative?
No, this was well before Trump. So this is a statement from the grammarologists. I think they were, and this is tongue-in-cheek, but it's a real statement. They
try to talk tongue-in-cheek sometimes. It doesn't work.
It's now completely appropriate to end your sentence with a dangling participle. So it's just an interesting piece of news. It's right up there with Pluto's no longer a planet. So all of you grammar folks who've been chasing kids around and saying, "You dangled your participle." Well,
boy, that's
the kid can turn around and go, "Yeah, and it's okay now."
That's weird.
It is weird.
I don't know that I really like the idea of removing the prohibition against dangling one's participles in public.
It makes you an old fogey. Next, you're going to say, "Stop dancing."
No, I'm not going to say stop dancing. But fear not, because I don't. So
you don't dance?
No. I used to.
Well, if you don't dance, and if you don't and your friends don't dance,
then they can't stop dancing.
Then they're no friends of mine.
I'm sure there was a reference there that I missed altogether.
Like I said, it's an old fogey thing. And I'm an old enough fogey that song is now played on classical radio and in classic rock radio. And it was too new for you.
So, oh, Too New for You. Is that the name of a group?
It should be. Too Legit.
Well, anyway, we are the Personal Wealth Coach, and that's the name of the radio program. It is not coincidentally also the name of an investment advisory firm, a fee-only fiduciary SEC-registered investment advisory firm in Salado. It's based in Salado, Texas, and has clients in lots and lots and lots of places in various parts of here, there, and yon. We normally at this point would ask you to give us a call. I guess you could just kind of fire a thought at us. Do you monitor email during this?
I do.
Okay.
I'm looking at it right now.
So you can send an email if you have a question to Jake@tpwc.com. and he will observe the email. And
we're going to tell you in advance, though, that there is an old adage, there are no such thing as stupid questions. However, that puts the onus on us because there's a lot of things called stupid answers, and we're great at those stupid answer things. Not that we intend to, but you know, if we're going to excel, we should excel.
Well, we work at it. So let's see what happened this week. Anything?
It's raining.
Well, no, that was just today. I'm just talking about, we do this once a week.
Right. The sun came up a lot of times. Well. Or either that or the world turned. We could argue that for a while if you wish.
Yeah. Well, it all depends on your point of view. And my point of view is living here on planet Earth that the sun came up. Although I didn't actually see it come up. I just noticed that it was dark and then it got light.
And on the space station, they just see the sun hiding behind the planet regularly.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So, well, the S&P 500 stock index, actually, if I were to do this properly, I would say the Standard Poor's 500 stock index, which is an index of stocks. I could go into all kinds of things. But
right.
The bottom line to it is, I think you know what it is. It actually fell almost 1% for the week, but the good news is it's still up roughly, for 1 year, it's up roughly 5%. Now, the interesting part of that, at least to me, is that all of that 5% has come since the election.
I have a mild self-congratulatory moment here. I have to wrench my shoulder out of socket and pat myself on the back. Ow! Okay. All right. There's enough of that. Do you remember last week when I said it was likely that the coming week would be a slight down because that tends to be what happens when we've hit a round number in the market?
Hmm. Yeah. Yeah. But it didn't get below the round number.
No. And it's not always the case that it gets below the round number. It is pretty usual that a round number gets broken and it drops a little bit.
So it's like
what I said is if it doesn't drop below the round number, in this case the Dow 19,000 mm-hmm, or the S&P mm-hmm. 500 2200, then we should expect probably better things for the rest of the next few weeks.
Is that kind of like the groundhog? The shadow in the groundhog?
Very, very much. It's very much like that in that I actually had a groundhog involved in the research that determined that round numbers issue.
Well, I've never actually used a groundhog, but I've often used a grounding rod, so that's close enough.
Right.
Anyway, what else happened is the two of our favorite governmental agencies, and it almost makes me happy, you know, as I said, almost, when I pay my taxes that I know I'm supporting these two charitable organizations. And we like them because they're full of bureaucrats.
Yes,
and
they are. They even label themselves a bureau.
And they're in two different departments in the government. One is in the Commerce Department. One's in the Labor Department, which are two departments that various presidential candidates over the years have promised that they would shut down and then enlarged. One is in the Commerce Department is the Bureau of Economic Analysis. And those guys are really analysis there. And, if I had to work someplace – I would love to work in the Bureau of Economic Analysis. I can just imagine the place is full of geeks.
It's full of bureaucrats.
Geeks, too, because they're analysts. They're bureaucratic analysts, which is the geekiest
form of life. They're Greek cats.
Okay, the Greek cats?
Yeah.
Okay.
They're a type of cat on the Broadway musical.
Yeah, oh, okay.
Just made that up.
Okay. Excuse me. I choked on that one. The other one is the Bureau of Labor Statistics, which is another place where I can just imagine lots of guys with eye shades and pocket protectors sitting around communicating over, did you notice this statistical anomaly here or this one there? And, of course, both of them are busy doing things. The Bureau of Labor Statistics actually made the big news this week in the economic world. It's generally credited to the DOL, the DOL. But it's actually the Bureau of Labor Statistics that does this. And they noted that the unemployment rate in the United States has now dropped to 4.6%, which, believe it or not, is important. It's important for a couple of reasons. One, it's a lot lower today than it was a few years ago. It was when President Obama took office, it was around 8%. He's about to leave office 8 years later. It's 6%.
Wait, before we go any further, we used a president's name here.
We did?
And yes, you said Barack, President Obama took office about 8 years ago, mm-hmm. and it was around 8%. That's a measurement point. It's not trying to attribute credit.
No,
anybody
I'm not.
That's listened to us for very long knows that we're not attributing credit there. But
no, President Obama had very little or nothing to do with this.
As President Trump or President-elect Trump has very little or nothing to do with the spending that's going on right now in holiday shopping.
Right. But the point is that we have these markers in history when we look at things and say, okay, this is a point when something changed. Now, the something that changed might not have anything to do with the economic results, but it's a good little marker to put in there.
And I'll use it one more quick other reference. We do the same thing with years. If you think about your shopping schedule or your business schedule, December 31st and January 1st fall in different years. You may have been planning to do a purchase on December 31st that you did on January 2nd. In your business operating routines, it shouldn't be separated. Well, you need that machine to do the thing, so you're getting it. But we still use the years to say, this year looks better than last year because you bought an extra machine. So it's just a measurement point, just for the folks out there listening that think that we just gave credit to a president. We don't give presidents credit for the economy. Just plain don't do it because it's not their fault. Anyway, I'm sorry, and I interrupted you, but I thought it was an important piece to throw in there.
Okay. So the this is the point that I think is important to understand. A 4.6% unemployment rate is about as low as it goes. In the late 1990s, we actually got down to about 4.3. But that 4.3 unemployment rate in the late 1990s was pretty significant in that it indicated we had pushed the envelope a little further than it probably ought to be pushed. The 4.3 number is also important because that is the percentage of white males in the United States that are unemployed, which are considered to be the core workforce. I realize you got a lot of other people. There's Hispanics, there's blacks, there's females, there's everything else. But there is a core workforce that the economists track as an indicator of what's happening at the centerpiece of the economy. And because very simply, women in the economy tend to the percentage of unemployment there tends to fluctuate far more widely than it does with men. In other words, in a high employment economy, women's unemployment rates go down further than men's do. And in a low performing economy, women's unemployment rates tend to go up higher than men's do.
Right. So I've got some pieces to add to that.
Okay.
You want to continue this here.
Here's the point. We're entering this, okay, 4.6 unemployment, headline news. Okay. If we're about to enter into a period of economic stimulus, then let's see what's going to happen. Higher paying jobs are going to theoretically appear. There's going to be more of them appear theoretically. So we're going to stimulate the economy. The question then comes down to where do the people come from to fill those higher paying jobs? We've had a drop in participation in the workforce, but a very careful look at that drop in participation says those people are not going to come back to work. And particularly if a lot of the work is in construction, since a lot of the people who dropped out are in their 50s, and they were working in an air-conditioned building, I somehow don't think you're going to get them to go to work on highway construction.
Right. There's. Let me throw this in here because it's adding to what you just said.
Mm-hmm.
There are a lot of economists out there that are really upset with this 4.6% number.
Mm-hmm.
They say it really should still be at 4.9%. Because if you remove the effect of about 226,000 people leaving the workforce – that's the number of people that left the workforce.
Right.
They're no longer looking. If they were still in the workforce, we would still be at a 4.9% unemployment. Wait, please.
Okay.
Wait. I pulled up some census information. This census information is stuff I've looked at in the past, but it's important. If, and it is, today's full employment Social Security age is the age 66, then we look back to say, all right, 66 years ago was 1950. In 1950, we had a significant spike in the baby boom population. So I'm looking back here at 1950, and we're talking about roughly 3.6 million people were born during the year of 1950, which is a significant increase over the years that had come before the baby boom. So 3.6 million people, and if you drop, you know, divide 3.6 by 12, it's not that hard. You get 300,000 a month. We had 226,000 people leave the workforce, which is less than all of the people reaching full retirement age right now.
Wait, wait. Just in that month, we had 226,000 people.
Right. Okay. And if you just take the numbers from the census, we should have had, if everybody took retirement at their full retirement age, we would have had 300,000 leave the workforce, which is what I'm saying, is that what, adding to what you had said a moment ago, is that those people aren't coming back. They don't want to come back. They don't deserve to come back. They deserve to spend their time enjoying their life. They've earned it. And the economists are going, well, this unemployment rate is counting all these retirees leaving, and we should not count retirees leaving. And I kind of squirm in my chair when I hear the economists talking about that and say, yeah, just look at the census information. It's there.
And the other thing that people sometimes talk about, yeah, but how about all the people who are underemployed or unemployed or working part-time or this discouraged group of people, if you combine the sometimes called the, what they call it, the U6 or something like that, the number of people who, if you take the people who are underemployed, they're working part-time or they're working at a job below their desired job or what they think they're capable of, plus the people that are unemployed, it's 9.3%. Now,
right.
Again, 8 years ago, this is just where the economic cycle runs. 8 years ago, it was around 16%. Actually, it was a little worse just before that. So what we see here, and this is the point that I'm trying to get to, is not only do we have unemployment, and we have the median wage in the United States at about $25, which is quite
an hour.
An hour.
Not a year.
Yeah, $25 an hour. Plus, what we're seeing is wages in the last 12 months have gone up 2.5%, while the consumer expenditure index, the personal consumer expenditure index, which is far more accurate than the CPI in measuring what people actually need to live, only went up 1.4%. So what we have is an increase in wages. Real wages after inflation and real inflation in terms of what they buy. We have 178,000 people. We've averaged 180,000 people a month in the last year, more employed. We've added 180,000 employed people net to the system every month for the last year. That's, 2.6 million people. No, 3.2 million people, I'm sorry. We've added to the workforce. More than that. I'll get the number here. I'll figure it out in a second. Okay, I'm trying to do this in my head. But, you know, whatever is 12 times 1.8 million, that's a lot of people. You know, we're talking like 20 million people more in the workforce now, actually working today than we had a year ago. So here's the issue. We have a stimulus coming. Yeah. What is it? Turn that number. 2.244 million people. The stimulus is going to happen. We're going to see, and I'm confident, given the makeup of Congress and given the new president-elect, we're going to see taxes come down, particularly for corporations. We're going to see the cost of doing business reduce. There's a push that was exemplified in the Carrier plant deal that just came out where apparently the president-elect talked the local folks into giving Carrier, I don't know if you heard about this,
$7 million of tax
per year.
Yeah.
So to keep 1,000 jobs, and if you want to figure that one up for just a second, $7 million to keep 1,000 jobs for 1 year. I think it would have been better if Carrier just laid them off and the local municipality had just paid them for that year to be laid off. But so there's a lot of funny things going on here, and here's one of them. Where do we find the people to fill the new jobs to build the infrastructure? Because the people who were laid off at, if the people, for example, were laid off at the Carrier plant, who have been earning around $25 an hour, they're not going to get $25 an hour to build roads. So they're not going to go out and build roads. Secondly, if you look at the average age of this, of the people in that factory and many factories across the country, they're in their 50s. And you realize that a person who's been working all their life in an air-conditioned plant turning screws is not going to go out and pick up a shovel to – how much was it per person, by the way? Did you figure that out?
Yeah, 1,000 people, $7 million is $7,000.
Okay, per person. So that's a pretty fair deal. So the point is – and there's another issue here. This caused a lot of angst in the surrounding communities. Why did it do that? Well, because that's – $7 million, for example, that doesn't go into building local roads and doesn't go into paying school teachers. And man, does it get complicated at that point when we try to figure out when we want to stick
jobs,
a stimulus
yeah,
in.
Did jobs get saved there? That's a good question. Well, on the surface, 1,000 jobs were saved. But did it cost someone else their jobs or a pay increase? That's where economics becomes much
messy.
More complex. Yeah. This is not something that you can say this is a clear win, except on television.
And here's the point that kind of crunches down to, and I think here in Texas we can really appreciate this. They can sure appreciate in Oklahoma right now. You give a big tax incentive to a company to keep 1,000 jobs in the area, that reduces the tax that goes to schools, roads, and all the other stuff that has to happen in a community, which means that the community government in a year or so will have to raise taxes on everybody else, well, probably on the people who stayed there too, to cover the fact that they gave a big tax break to Carrier. Now, if I could go on here, there's a bigger
sure.
example. Oklahoma is apparently largely moving or has moved to 4-day school weeks in their public schools because
they don't have money.
They don't have enough money to run their school system. Now, there's a lot of debate over how that should work out and whether they should consolidate their 500 and some odd school districts into about 70, which is how many counties they have, one school district per county. But all that. That is very questionable whether that would actually save any money or not. Here's the issue. If you look back during the oil boom, Oklahoma was giving huge tax credits. In other words, basically saying to a company, if you'll come in and drill for oil here and move this production here and hire a bunch of people, we will give you some massive tax credits on what you're doing in the oil fields. Well, the tax credits are still there, and the oil companies have now gone, and a lot of the jobs have disappeared as the oil price has dropped. And here's the most fascinating thing about it. In giving the tax credit to Carrier and in giving the tax credit to the oil companies, almost 100 – if you say that a tax credit is equivalent to giving a grant to somebody, okay, a certain
right.
amount of money.
Yeah.
The benefits to that almost all left the state of Oklahoma. And almost all will leave the place where the Carrier workers are because it's United Technologies, which is a massive multinational corporation that gets the tax break.
Right.
So the bottom line to it is it was a transfer in the Carrier plant of $7 million from the local economy to the shareholders of United Technologies to keep 1,000 jobs in Indianapolis.
Right. I think this is the clearest thing that we can say here. We believe in small government. We believe that if the government is doing its job and making sure that people aren't being scammed, being hurt by other people, not stealing from each other, that's the limit that it should be doing. It should very clearly understand that taking its taxes from people and giving benefits to some people with those taxes, not based on income, not based on anything other than don't leave, they're not actually benefiting the community very much. And if you look at the pay scale of the folks that are working there, it definitely benefited the 1,000 workers.
Oh, yeah.
So let's not say that there's no good that happened here.
Mm-hmm.
But they were leaving for a reason. They were leaving because they were not competitive.
Right.
And if as a percentage of the operating costs, that plant's $7 million is probably a very low percentage. And if the trend just keeps going.
And that's the reason that the local municipalities, including the one that generated the emergency tax break, are concerned.
Right. If the trend just continues, next year that's going to be a smaller, it's going to need to go up to keep those jobs there. And the year after that, it'll have to go up more so that they can continue to be competitive. Because the reality is that it's an inefficient way of making air conditioners compared to other ways that are available.
One of the issues here, and I think everybody said, oh, that's cool, they gave a tax break. They give tax break to companies all the time. Generally speaking, communities give tax breaks to companies that are coming in and building new facilities.
Because the cost of the building is huge.
Yeah, and you're going to employ a lot of construction workers, and there's going to be a lot of local money generated in the economy to build the new building. And the tax breaks that a corporation gets for coming in and bringing an industrial plant or something to a community have a sunset date. We'll give you for 5 years, you won't pay any property taxes or something like that. And they add all that up and say that's what you're going to get. Here's the problem with giving tax breaks to companies that are already there. No new revenue is going to be generated in the community because of those tax breaks that are given. And somebody could argue, well, these people who are working will continue to work and they will continue to pay taxes. The problem is, they may not even live in that community. People commute in from other towns. And so there's a lot of complexity here. But the biggest single one is, and I think it's one that I actually believe are going to see discussed, because the Republicans in Congress are balking at the House of Representatives at a provision right now in a clean water bill. Are you aware of the controversy that's going on?
Yeah,
there,
yeah.
Where the water bill is passed by the Senate and supported by the Democrats, says the steel, any materials used to effect this $11 billion grants that are going out to communities all across the country to repair their water systems, everything must be everything in there must be produced in the United States. And here's the funny thing. There are a lot of companies in the United States that produce steel and other materials that can't certify that everything that they put in that steel pipe, for example, was made in the United States. So automatically they get ejected from the system, whereas other companies that are probably have a higher cost of doing business are going to get to supply the pipes. What's more, if you look at steel pipes, which is what it specifically addresses, and you look at the companies that produce 100% of the steel pipe and all the materials and everything else about the companies, 100% in the United States, you make an interesting discovery. There is not enough production to meet that $11 billion demand, which means they're going to raise their prices dramatically. And here's the weirdest thing about it. You know how they're probably going to fill the orders?
How?
They're going to order steel pipes from other companies. But since the company that is supplying the steel pipe, when they make steel pipes, make them in the United States, but for their surplus, they order other steel pipes from other companies. So what will happen is the steel pipes they normally would have sent that are made in the United States to their regular customers will be replaced by steel pipes that are made in China, so that they can send the steel pipes that are made in the United States to the water supply repair systems, which is why the government, in my opinion, should not be telling people where the pipe should be made before they put it in the ground.
Right. And here's probably a key here. There's multiple keys. Donald Trump was elected with a platform of lowered regulation, but also a platform of fighting NAFTA, fighting foreign trade deals.
Which means more regulation.
Right. So internal, we may lower regulations, but we have become interconnected with Mexico and with Canada and with a lot of other places in how we produce things. If we start putting, beginning with something like this, strictures on where the pipe was made, then we got to go all the way back and figure out, okay, where was it mined? Was it mined? Iron ore? And I mean, because eventually that's what it comes down to. When the rules come out, they get more and more complex. They don't get simpler.
Well,
you don't hear about the government saying, let's make these rules simpler very often. It's just rare.
The bill that came out of the Senate, which was verbally supported by President Trump, President-elect Trump, was you have to go all the way from the mine to the delivery truck.
Yeah.
It has to be produced in the United States. And yet that is so amazingly difficult. For instance, what if the generator on the delivery truck was made in Mexico? Or the delivery truck was partially made? Nope, got to get a different truck.
Right. What if it's a recycling facility in the United States that's taking the metal from other sources? What if there's a Toyota car?
Oh, no. Well, now the Toyota car.
It may be a 1970s Toyota car. Okay. The frame went in here. Now, that steel wasn't mined here. It wasn't. That's really seriously the extent to which the government takes this.
And if it's a simple, the problem is with a simple rule where the Congress or the president tries to control economic activity, it becomes so complex to follow at the level where the rubber meets the road, quite literally, at the rubble where businesses, and we have a business, so we understand what seems like a very, very simple and fair rule to somebody sitting in Washington. When it actually hits the business, you go, oh, no, there's another 10 hours per month of regulatory and paperwork compliance.
Yeah, you're going to need to order 3 more reams of paper because I have to print the rule out now so to see if I can understand it.
Well, you know, I was just looking at that, and there's this inherent conflict that I think we're going to run during the Trump administration. We're probably going to run head on into. We want to, let's lower regulation, lower requirements, but we're going to issue a bunch of new regulations to keep jobs in America. And it will, because we'll have to hire more accountants and more clerks to keep up with the rules about keeping the jobs and all the production in the United States.
And now, said all that, the regulatory environment is likely to improve under Trump where it would have been unlikely to improve under Clinton.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, one of the things I think we deal with is simple solutions to complex problems generally produce bigger complex problems.
Right. Particularly when the government's the one that comes up with the solution.
And speaking of complex problems, we need to keep KTEM on the air and Town Square profitable. So that means people pay to provide their advertisements, and we have to run some of those. So you are listening to the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And we'll be back on the other side of these very, very important words from KTM sponsors with more of our drill. And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And we're talking about we still don't have phones, right?
I don't know. They did something to the phones, but yeah. I don't know if we're ready for it.
They came sweeping through here and unplugged things and plugged things back in and looked very official and then left. Another big thing that happened in the economy, it's a big thing, is the Bureau of Economic Analysis, one of my favorite organizations, the BEA, which is part of the Commerce Department, which a succession of presidents have wanted to get rid of and all of whom have made larger. The BEA upgraded, you know, you like when you get a software upgrade, upgraded the report on the gross domestic product of the United States, and it now seems that instead of 2.9%, the gross domestic product of the United States grew in the third quarter 3.2% on an annualized basis. Now, is that significant?
Yes.
Why is it significant? Nobody's answering.
It's a good question. Why is it significant?
It
already happened. So why is it significant? Oh, yeah, we did well the last quarter.
It's significant because when we look back and see what was happening in the third quarter, now that we've got the data in and we can take a look at it, what we're seeing is an increase in economic activity in the United States across the board, mainly that the big engine that drives the United States economy, somewhere between 67 and 70% of our economy, is consumers buying things. And it appears that in the third quarter, consumers started buying things again. And there's a lot of anecdotal evidence out there that they're continuing to buy things. Now, what we suggested when the price of oil dropped and the gasoline prices dropped about a year ago, that this was going to put more money in people's pockets. And then the question is what they would do with it. What they did with it for a while was pay down their debts. It appears that they're maybe done paying down their debts and they're actually going to go out and buy, they're actually going out and buying things now, which would suggest that 2017 is going to look better because these things take a while to build up. They take a while to happen. And the momentum is there. And we're starting to see, lo and behold, in the stores, in the retail stores, we're starting to see prices rise.
Right. Not just retail prices there. And I'm going to hit some numbers from the GDP stuff. And this is not the number that you'll read most commonly about GDP. This is a percentage increase or decrease from the quarter before. So this is one that people can understand a little bit better, I think, than just saying what's the numbers that are out there. So I'm going to hit some numbers that I dug down into the depths of the GDP. Durable good orders. We've talked about that quite a bit over the past year. Durable goods are things that you purchase that you expect to last a while. Washing machines, dryers, refrigerators, big equipment for companies. The big stuff that it takes you a while to replace. If something breaks, you might replace it relatively quickly. But if it's just, it keeps doing it, it's just doing it less and less efficiency, with less and less efficiency over time, it takes a long time for you to finally say, all right, we're going to get a new one. Those orders this last quarter were up 11.6% from the quarter before. There's more. Non-residential structures, building, office buildings, that sort of thing. Last year in 2015, all year long, in the beginning of this year even, we had shrinkage in this area. We had people spending less on it than before, less and less on it before. Well, we're spending now 10% or 10.1% more in the third quarter on these buildings than we did the quarter before that. We're seeing that's a big jump. Usually we're talking about single-digit type moves. We think a 5% movement is really big. When it's 10 or 11%, we look at that and go, whoa, there's massive stuff going on. There's another really big one. And this is one that is harder to understand because the dollar has been very, very strong. That means things made in the United States get more expensive elsewhere.
Right.
Our exports were up 10% from the quarter before. And our goods were up, goods that were being exported rather than services, 14%. This is with an increase in the value of the dollar, which means that stuff is more expensive overseas than it was, and yet people want a lot of it.
Because it's a very good reason.
What's that?
It's goods, not bads.
Oh, yes. If they were selling bads, it probably wouldn't have done as well.
So we sell very little bad overseas. And that's the truth. I mean, I say that term tongue in cheek, obviously. But in the United States, we make good stuff. Now, why do we make good stuff? Here we go back to regulations again. One of the reasons that the things we make in the United States are so well respected overseas and people are willing to pay more for them
even more now with the strong dollar
than they do for something, let's say, made in China. And I use this example. There's certainly lots of other examples. But if you were, let's say, I don't care where you are, India, and you're part of the rising middle class in India, and you have children, and you're concerned that they're going to get toys with lead in the paint.
You don't buy from China.
You don't buy from China. You don't buy from India. If you can afford it, you buy toys made in the United States of America, at least by an American company that have, because they have a reputation for being higher quality. By the way, there's a little flaw in that logic, which you might want to address at some point.
What's that?
Cars made by General Motors, same model, same identical everything, for sale in the United States and for sale in Mexico, have dramatically different crash characteristics.
Yes, they do. They do. Absolutely.
But if they're being exported by a retail outlet in the United States, and that's what we're actually seeing some of this happen. For instance, if you order from Amazon and you're in, Mexico or you're in India, and people do, by the way.
Yes, they do.
They're getting something that has to meet a United States standard, and as much as a pain it is as it has been, and a lot of complaints about getting the lead out of toy paint, for example, it's working.
Yeah, this is important because it sounds like we've got a contradiction going between us right now. We're sitting here saying regulations, over regulations are really bad.
Yep.
And now we're touting the regulations as being one of the strengths of the American product. And both things are true.
Right.
Regulations are absolutely important.
Mm-hmm.
We're not saying that regulations should all go away. That's anarchy. That is anybody's allowed to steal from anybody else. What we definitely are saying is that our paint doesn't include lead, and it's not primarily because of the government. The government saying, hey, take the lead out of your paint is there. They say that. But the consequences for having lead in the paint on the governmental side are very light compared to the consumer side, because people get the pants sued off of them for mm-hmm. having lead paint in their toys.
But you can only sue somebody for having lead paint in toys because there's a law against having lead paint in toys.
Exactly. So the concept here where there's some kind of governmental agency that's regulating and controlling and policing on the kind of micromanagement level that we're seeing a lot these days, that's a problem. If there is a clear incentive to people not doing something in the marketplace because they will get sued, that's a much better thing, and that's part of the reason why their airbags exist all over the place in the United States. When people are driving, it's the norm to have airbags. There's no governmental agency that says all cars must have airbags. Doesn't exist. You can still buy cars on the economy side that do not have airbags.
Old used cars?
It's not even used. New cars.
Really?
Being created without airbags, it's still legal. Now, most car companies don't do it anymore because they get sued by people who say, I thought it had an airbag after an accident.
Hmm.
So the standard there, and it's harder to do when you're talking about gas mileage, because how do you sue over gas mileage, except that if somebody claims that you get a better gas mileage than you do, you can sue over it. So Volkswagen is getting fined by the government for saying bad things about or good things about its own gas mileage.
Rigging their vehicles, their diesel vehicles, so that when they were tested by independent laboratories or by the government to see what if they meet the Clean Air Act requirements,
right,
then their computers would actually sense that a test was going on and change the way the engine processed fuel to have lower emissions.
Exactly. So they're getting fined by the government over that. And the fine is a relatively large fine. We're talking about eight figures. It's like $140 million that they're talking about. The amount of money that Volkswagen is having to pay to the dealerships to cover lawsuits is in the billions of dollars. So to think that our governmental agencies are the ones with the big stick, no, they're just the ones with the microscopes and the magnifying glasses to say you're doing this wrong, do it that way, when you may be doing it right.
Well,
the consumer is the one that should have the big stick. And that's, you've heard me say that a lot on this program, that if there's a governmental agency that fines a company, they should take the fine of that company and pay it to the people that were damaged, not use it to buy public service announcements that nobody listens to.
We do.
Yeah, we do long enough to say, yeah, oh, man, that's dumb.
So, yeah, there's a balance in all of this, and it's an important balance in all of this. And we next hour, I'd like to get into a little bit of the reason that sometimes the government needs to make a rule, and sometimes the government needs to enforce it,
and sometimes they don't.
Right.
Finding out when is the important part.
Right. That's exactly it. While we're at it, there was an interesting, at least from, and we put this in the newsletter this week. One of those things that I think gives you some insight into what goes on in the big world and why it happens. There's an assumption with the price of gold that is, if inflation starts up, the price of gold will go up really fast because the value of the dollar will decline. Well, what we're seeing is inflation starting to creep upward, but not too much. But what we're big thing is the median wage, not the total wages, which is reported in the unemployment report, but the median wage in the United States is rising, according to the Atlanta Fed, at a 3.9% per year rate right now. Almost 4% a year is what the median wage rise is right now. Now, if we have wages going up at 4% and employment going up, there's going to be a lot more money chasing the same amount of goods and services in the economy, which means we're probably going to see inflation in the future, which is why the bond interest rates have nearly doubled since July on the Treasury bond.
You have just very easily segued into the Federal Reserve.
Well, I'm going to talk about the price of gold here for just a second.
Okay, all right. Okay,
the Federal Reserve is probably going to do something, but that's almost a moot point at this time. Quarter point rise there. The price of gold dropped in the last quarter about 13%, somewhere between 11, depending on where you look at the price of gold, 11 to 13% drop in the wholesale price of gold. Now, if you go to sell your gold that you bought 90 days ago, you would actually see more like a 20% drop because of the transaction costs and retail and things of that nature. But this is the point I'm trying to make. If inflation, if rising inflation would make the price of gold go up, which it normally does, then why did the price of gold drop 13% during that period of time? I say normally there's this perception that it will. Meanwhile, stocks have risen 5%. And the answer may be, and I've done a lot of research on this, the fact that the Indian government withdrew from circulation the 1,000 rupee note.
I think talking about that, I have a big intention of spending some more time on that next hour.
Okay,
it's a big deal.
The big thing is that there's a lot of people who didn't get paid in India.
Right.
There's a lot of economic uncertainty in India.
And there's people that did get paid that had their money become worthless overnight.
Right. So what happened is people in India apparently started selling gold and buying dollars. So the dollar went up 5%, at least partially perhaps because of that, and the price of gold dropped. People are converting gold into dollars, and people in the United States think gold has something to do with the government in the United States and inflation in the United States and the Federal Reserve. And in fact, what's happening is the Prime Minister of India withdrew the 1,000 rupee notes, so the price of gold dropped 13%. Boop. I think that's one of those weirdnesses that people don't take into account when they look at the economy and what they're investing in.
Right. There's a lot more to talk about on that subject next hour, for sure.
Yeah, we can talk about Italy, too.
Yes, Italy and India. The eyes have it as far as the
What was that group?
Name.
The pigs? Was the pigs before?
Yes, now Portugal, Italy, Greece, Spain.
Yes, and now it's going to be the eyes.
And I think there was another eye in there, in Ireland as well.
So. Oh, yeah, yeah. The P-I-I-G-S. Okay.
Well, we have a caller, and we'll see if it actually works. So I'm going to attempt to put the caller on the air. Caller, go ahead and give us a shot. Are you there?
Oh, hey. Sorry, I'd about given up.
I don't blame you. I gave up a long time ago.
We only have a couple of minutes, so what you got?
Yep. This is Jim from down the road in Austin here. Hi.
Hi.
Just wanted to know if sometime during the show you could talk about something. I know you're very interested in education. I know, especially since the naming of the new secretary and the attacks from the left about vouchers. And, of course, there are all the political controversies about testing and vouchers and charter schools and so forth. I wonder if you could just talk about some of that and some of the truths and untruths.
Do you want us to get in a lot of trouble? Because no matter what we say about education, there's going to be somebody that's going to get angry.
Yeah, and we've got about 2 minutes this hour, so we will definitely hit that next hour. It may even be the first thing we talk about. It's a really near and dear to our hearts, as you know.
Yes, I knew you'd be interested in that. And after last week, and some folks who were, a little concerned about the new secretary, so I thought it'd be a wonderful topic for you. So
okay.
Thanks very much.
Thank you. Thank you for calling.
Thanks
Jim.
For the call.
Bye.
And we're getting close to the end of the first hour, but that's not the end of what we do. We have a second hour that arrives in our lives. And we actually make use of it from time to time.
We have more hours when we're off the air where we walk around and do things. But as far as being on the air, we have one more hour this week.
And is there anything else we can talk about in the last
half a minute or so?
Half a minute or so?
Yeah, I want to talk some more about the Federal Reserve next hour. I want to talk about Italy and India. We want to talk about education. Reform and vouchers, all that good stuff. In the meantime, if you would like to contact us off the air, we have voicemail waiting. We actually give advice to high net worth folks on how to invest and what they should do in their businesses and a lot of other areas. So if you want to reach that number off the air, we've got voicemail waiting locally at...
It's Air Course Area Code 254, which is local, 947-1111.
Or you can reach that number toll-free at 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. You can reach us by email at jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com. You can listen to our podcasts in case you didn't get enough insanity today. You can read newsletters and our philosophy.
And stuff.
I highly recommend it. You'll see our faces made for radio waiting for you there. That's a little moment of truth for you to see us. Until next hour, this has been The Personal Wealth Coach.
Your Fox News station in Central Texas. News Radio 1400 KTEM AM. Temple, Belton, Killeen, Fort Hood.